Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Broadhaven. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'm your host for tonight.
Now, what do you make of this next story? An investigation has begun into a claim that something strange came out of the skies and landed in the Welsh village of Broadhaven near Haverford West. Whatever it was spotted 3 times by children from the local school.
On February the 4th, 1977, 14 school children were playing outside in the schoolyard while on morning break at the Broadhaven Primary School. Broadhaven is a small coastal village situated in St. Bride's Bay, Pembrokeshire, Wales. Each of the 14 children would then bear witness to a life-changing and extraordinary moment when they each saw an unidentified flying object in a neighbouring field. During the incident, at one point, what happened to be some sort of humanoid creature wearing a silver-looking bodysuit was seen near the now-landed craft. According to the BBC, multiple students reported seeing the events unfold that day, and word travelled fast through the small school, town, and wider area in the coastal community of South Wales. It wasn't long before 10-year-old David Davis had heard about the events unfolding at the school, and even at that young age, David was extremely sceptical as to the veracity and truthfulness of the stories that he was hearing. Young David decided that the only logical course of action was to go out as soon as the bell rang and take a look for himself. Well, that was 48 years ago this week, and the majority of those children aren't talking too much about what happened anymore. But David Davis is, and has been ever since that day, and at oftentimes at great personal cost to himself and his reputation. Tonight, Dead Souls Media will take a look at the events surrounding what became known as the Broadhaven UFO. We will hear from Davis and a number of other locals from the sleepy seaside town, and also look at several other incidents from that time period in Wales, which caused many to dub the local area as the Welsh UFO Triangle.
1977 was a year the pupils of Broadhaven will never forget.
I can't say any more than it was a UFO. It was an unidentified flying object. All of us kids, especially the boys, we were familiar with everything that NATO had in the air at the time. We were so close to RAF Broadie, we could identify anything up there. There are a lot of people who have dismissed it, and I'd just like them to look at the new evidence that's come along now and look at the story again with an open mind.
There was a spate of sightings after the strange goings-on at Broadhaven Primary School. This area became known as the Dyfed Triangle because so many people said that they'd seen UFOs.
The school was situated, as stated, in Broadhaven, which is right on the southwest coast of Wales. It's a really rural school. Small, the village is popular now for surfers and holidaymakers, with its beautiful beaches, small-town traditional shops, and breathtaking views of the coastline. There were only around 125 pupils at the school then. Everybody knew each other, and there was a very close, family-like atmosphere there. A proper small Welsh town vibe. It was just a normal day in February, so the dead of winter. It was a drizzly, grey and damp day, and bitterly ice cold. Throughout the day, children were coming in from their break times, and they were saying that they had seen a flying saucer or something strange flying over the school and perimeter fields. Pupils and teachers inside the school, understandably, were sceptical. They didn't believe a single word that the kids who had been outside were saying. Flying saucers were purely in the realm of old-fashioned 1950s science fiction movies. This was a time pre-Star Wars and pre-Close Encounters of the Third Kind, so UFOs and aliens were not in the public interest at the time, and children certainly had no interest in them. At the time of the final bell, at the end of the day, a few of the older children decided to have a look in the vicinity of the area that the other children had said they saw the strange craft. At the edge of the school grounds, the older children looked out, but couldn't see anything out of the ordinary. Several boys, led by 10-year-old David Davis, climbed over the exterior fence and made their way into the field, where Davis had been told by some of his classmates that they had seen the object a few hours before. As Davis and his friends crossed the field to the rear of the school, something popped up silently from behind a small group of trees. Effortlessly, and without fanfare. It was a silver disc-shaped object. It was about 45 feet in length and seemed to have a pearlescent finish to it. It hung in the air without making a sound. The sighting was fleeting, lasting only for a matter of 5 to 10 seconds, before it slowly disappeared down behind some trees again. Davis stated that at no time was he fearful. There was no fright in him whatsoever. However, he added, he did get the sudden and immediate urge to run away. Davis couldn't put his finger on the reason. He just knew, deep down inside, that he had to run from it. It didn't seem like my natural reaction, Davis later commented. There was no fear, just a deep instinct to run, but I didn't know what I was running from. The only emotion Davis remembers feeling was inquisitiveness. But despite this, there remained this strange compulsion to get the hell away from there. The craft was about 45 feet long. It equated, from the side, to about the size of an average bus. It was silver, and the children described it as being cigar-shaped, with a central dome that covered the middle third of the body of the craft. And on top of that, a red pulsating light. The light was flat. It didn't stand out like a light on the top of a police car or an ambulance, Davis said. The glow seemed to come from the top of the dome itself, rather than a light which was protruding. Davis described what the craft appeared to be doing when he first saw it. He said, quote,
it was obviously obstructed by some trees that were about 200 to 300 yards away from the school itself. As I was trying to climb over the fence, it actually appeared from behind the trees, rose up just above the tree canopy, and there was a slight movement. No sound, but there was a movement to the craft. Then it simply disappeared back down behind the trees again.
As stated, there was no noise from the craft at all. However, there was a little bit of wind at the time, a gentle breeze. The weather conditions weren't perfectly clear, but absolutely no noticeable noise. By this point, Davis was alone. He had walked out into the adjacent field ahead of the other boys he left the school with. Davis has said that he went to the area to disprove what the other kids were saying at the time. He claims that he had no idea that he would even be seeing an object like he did. How could he? Flying saucers were the things of science fiction. To David Davis, they didn't feature in his reality or spectrum of interest before that day, he said. Following the sighting, Davis said he was overjoyed, excited and full of adrenaline. It was at the end of the school day and Davis and five friends used to get a scheduled school taxi that took them home. When Davis got home, he said his mother saw how animated he was and she asked him what was wrong. Davis told her that him and several other children at school had seen some sort of UFO. Davis says that his mother could spot a lie from about a mile off and she immediately realized that what he was telling her was genuine and factual. Davis said that his mother, at the time, knew a gentleman by the name of Randall Jones Pugh, who was a local veterinary surgeon in the area. So he was a man of medicine, a man of science. But the other thing that Jones Pugh did was that he was an investigator and researcher for an organization called BUFORA, which is the British Unidentified Flying Object Research Association. They are a well-respected and renowned group within the United Kingdom, and at the time, they were quite prolific. So Davis said his mother gave him a phone call. Jones Pugh paid Davis a visit and spoke to him at great length, gathering as much information as he could. Both Davis and Jones Pugh went back down to the site where the object had been sighted. Jones Pugh also spoke with a number of the other children who had seen the craft that day. Almost right away, a media circus enveloped the location and those who had prayed witness to it.
Well, I saw the spaceship. I didn't see the man. The spaceship, it looked a cigar shape with a dome on it. And it had a yellowy, orange to red light on the top of it.
How clearly did you see it?
Well, I couldn't see its face because it was too far away.
Now, you say you saw a man as well, did you?
Yes.
And what about him?
Well, he was too far away to be seen as well.
My friend Philip here was trying to find a way over the stream and I was looking at the bushes up the top of the trees. And then suddenly the silver cigar-shaped object seemed to pop up from behind the bushes and trying to take off, then it disappeared again.
Are you sure it wasn't perhaps just a helicopter or an aircraft from the airfield near here?
A helicopter could land there, but that's private property over there. And if they landed there, they could be prosecuted. And with an aircraft, the only thing they could get in there was a Harrier.
Were you frightened at the time?
Yes.
Why?
Well, I thought there would be a whole arm inside there or something.
The media circus started quite rapidly. The incident happened on a Friday, and by the following Monday morning, reporters were all over the scene. By the end of the week, Davis commented, his family had to take the phone off the hook and stop answering the front door. Additionally, the Broadhaven Primary School was also bombarded with phone calls from all over the world. Reporters calling from every corner of the globe, TV crews wanting to visit and conduct interviews with everyone involved. The subsequent Monday morning, the children returned to school, and Ralph Llewellyn, the school headmaster, had obviously been alerted to the situation and of what had happened. He wanted to document the children's accounts, but also test the veracity of the stories they each had. He placed all the kids in exam conditions, sitting them apart and asked them not to speak with each other. He asked them to write a small report of what had happened, accompanied by a drawing or sketch of what they saw. There was no collusion between the children. Their accounts and images turned out to all be incredibly similar and identical. You can Google the images and view them online. You'll recall that this was 1977. There was no internet, no mobile phones, and the children all lived in a rural community miles apart. It was impossible for them to have colluded on their story over the weekend. And all of the children were quick to confirm that too. In the years since the incident, Headmaster Llewellyn has stated publicly that he doesn't believe in UFOs or aliens. However, he firmly believed that the children had seen something extraordinary. He was reluctant to hazard a guess as to what he thought could explain the sighting. But the children, as they got older, have spoken in the years since the incident, and they have all said that the headmaster was deeply affected by the sighting that day, and it changed his whole demeanour. But while this is all interesting, in and of itself, there is more to this story. Several days later, on Thursday, February the 10th, another incident occurred at the school. A teacher and three of the school lunch ladies made another sighting. Whilst the four women would go on public record and say what they had seen that day, they chose to remain entirely anonymous after seeing the fanfare of media descend on the small town following the first incident involving the children. All four of the women who made the second sighting were said to be calm, down-to-earth, and honest ladies, not regularly known to entertain flights of fancy or tall stories. The teacher involved specifically was said to have a reputation as extremely practical and intelligent. They were each considered genuine and truthful in their observation, as none of them had the characters to ever make up anything within this realm. So what did this sighting entail? Well, they saw a craft which matched in description with what the boys had seen the week prior. In fact, it was the same location too, the field next to the school property. But on this occasion, the four women said, they saw the craft actually touch down and land. Further, they witnessed a humanoid figure in a slim-fitting silver bodysuit stood next to the craft, looking for something, before it appeared to meet the women's eyes who were looking on. The women all described the creature as having dark grey skin on its head and pointy ears. This is extraordinary when you think about it, but many will dismiss the claims as absurd and pure fantasy. But just keep in mind how credible these women were, and also remember how the schoolboys, 14 of them, had all recalled and drew images of what they saw too under strict examination conditions, and all their accounts matched entirely. But if that wasn't enough for you, over the following 14-month period, a total of 453 reports were made to local authorities, police, and the military, which had bases in the area. The reports were of UFOs, strange phenomena, and bizarre creatures. A few examples of these, quoted from the Bufora investigation report into the phenomena at this time, evidences. Mr. Donald Harris, an insurance salesman from Haverford West, witnessed a huge 100-foot silvery metallic saucer-shaped craft hovering above a farm on March 12, 1977. It hung silently in the air for a few minutes before ascending straight up at quick speed and out of sight. Norman Davis and his wife Maureen saw a cigar-shaped saucer moving at rapid speed up ahead of their car while driving between Newgate Beach and Simpson Cross on April of 1977. Caroline Marsh reported that she awoke at 3 a.m. on April 27th and saw a bright light emanating from a craft which was hovering outside her window in Druidston. The craft, she said, made no sound as she observed it for a few minutes. Mr. Bernard Lewis and his wife Elsie had a complete electrical blackout at 8:45 p.m. on June the 1st, 1977. They stated that they heard a deep hum coming from outside their house in Haroldston West. They stated they went to the front door and saw a red glowing object hovering above their house. The object was oval in shape, like a rugby ball, and the lights beneath the craft seemed to pulsate. After the craft quickly accelerated into the night, Mrs. Lewis is quoted as saying, "The power returned to their home immediately." As I stated, these are just a handful of sightings from that time. There are hundreds more. But another that I would like to touch on is the event that a local hotelier named Rosa Granville and her daughter Francine actually witnessed. Their sighting came shortly after the children in Broadhaven Primary School had made their observation, and at the time Granville didn't say a word to anyone. She was scared by what she saw. But she said it was seeing and hearing the stories from the children and hearing how people were calling them liars and fantasists that made her come forward and say, quote, "No, this is real. I witnessed something strange too." I'm just going to pause the episode here to invite you guys who haven't already done so to head over to our Patreon and sign on up. It gives you access to extra episodes, articles, blogs, and research material, and all for just $2 a month. All that for less than the price of a cup of coffee. That's a hell of a bargain, I don't mind saying. If you're interested in joining us, head to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. We can't wait to see you guys over there. And for those of you who have already signed up, thank you so, so much. We are so ingratiated to have you with us. While you are there, reach out and say hello. Okay, now, back to the episode. Rosa Granville was originally from Barcelona in Spain, but she moved to Wales in 1967 after she married a local man by the name of Martin Granville. The couple purchased and ran the Haven Fort Hotel, a Grade II listed building. Now, for my listeners from outside the UK, listed buildings are buildings of historic value and meaning, and they are protected under UK law from structural changes and demolition. The owners also have a legal obligation to maintain the upkeep and maintenance of the properties to protect them due to their historical importance. As you can imagine, as the UK is so old, we have buildings that date back over 1500 years. So lots of historical and important structures from history that we, as a nation, hold in quite high regard and historical importance. Anyway, the Haven Fort Hotel was one of these listed buildings. It's still there to this day, although no longer a hotel, it's now a private residence. It's a Victorian marine villa, built in the Gothic style, occupying a dramatic scenic location on the headland between the towns of Broadhaven and Littlehaven. For those of you who are curious as to what it looks like, you can view images online by searching the Haven Fort Hotel at postal code SA623LA. Granville stated that on the night of Monday, April the 19th, she witnessed a craft land on her property. Rosa described seeing a, quote, large aircraft outside her bedroom window hovering in the night sky. She furthered that the craft emitted a heat that she could feel through her window. Upon gently touching down onto the ground, the strange vessel left a mark on the grass at the bottom of the family's property. She also states that she saw two creatures standing beside the craft. They were wearing tight-fitting silver clothing, she said, and had no facial features that she could make out. She recalls them having very long arms and very long legs, however. Tony Cowan, the RAF press officer at the Royal Air Force Base, RAF Broadie, located around 8 miles north from Broadhaven, investigated the craft landing at Granville's property after she had written a letter to her Member of Parliament representative, Nicholas Edwards. Edwards in turn passed the information on to the Ministry of Defence, who instructed Cowan to investigate. Cowan had received a number of reports, complaints and cries for help from members of the community who had witnessed strange events, so he was keen to head out and meet with Granville. He believed her story, he said. She was clearly terrified and telling the truth. Further, there were what looked like scorch marks in the grass and a ridge where a heavy object had flattened the grass in the area of the property where Rosa had seen the craft land. The location of all of the sightings and their close proximity to not just a Royal Air Force base at RAF Broadie, 8 miles north of Broadhaven, where the Royal Air Force trained pilots on Hawker Hunter jets and housed a tactical weapons unit, but also a US naval station, the US Naval Advanced Amphibious Base at Milford Haven, around 6 miles south of Broadhaven, is certainly very interesting. The US Navy station was said by US authorities to be a maritime research facility, but in reality it was a top secret naval base which tracked the movements of Soviet submarines using a network of underwater microphones. There was even a top-secret UK military rocket testing station around 40 miles north at Aberporth. UFO reports are often cited in locations near and around military and weapon stations. In fact, a significant percentage of sightings occur in these locations, which have given rise to many UFO experts saying that they believe that these craft have an interest in our military and weaponry. I think this is certainly food for thought. Many skeptics, on the other hand, and to bring balance to these claims, will say that these sightings are not unidentified flying object of extraterrestrial origin, but rather experimental military aircraft, which is why they are seen near their home bases. This is also food for thought. although the militaries of both the United States, United Kingdom, and a number of other NATO countries have always strenuously denied these objects as being theirs, or experimental aircraft. And whilst you could sneer at those denials and say, well, of course they're going to deny the existence of top-secret aircraft, it is worth noting that the same governments have also spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the decades into quietly researching the phenomenon too. If you knew what they were, surely that would be a monumental waste of money, manpower, resources, and everything else that accompanies that. But wait, there is more to the Granville family's experiences other than that single craft landing at their hotel. Only a few days later, during the same week that the school children witnessed the UFO near their school, Rosa Granville's daughter Francine, who was 18 at the time, experienced a strange encounter of her own. It was around 2 a.m. in the morning when the doorbell rang. The family immediately thought it was strange given the time of night, but also because they had not seen anyone drive or walk up their driveway. Their living room overlooked it, and they always saw people coming. The driveway was lit up with street lamps. The family heard the doorbell ring and Francine headed to the front door to answer it. "Stood there," she said, "were two guys. They looked like identical twins. They had hair that was slicked back and incredibly smooth, wax-like complexions. The strange-looking men asked her in unison whether her mother was home, so Francine went to get her. When Rosa arrived at the door, the men said to her again in unison, quote, 'We'd like to come back and speak to you at length, but we have an appointment at Croes Goch.' The men then turned to walk away and seemingly vanished. Rosa and Francine said they looked out the door and they had completely disappeared. We didn't see them walk or drive away. Rosa said of the incident, quote, 'I got a bit worried about this because, I mean, they looked so odd.' Rosa was scared and her husband was not at home at the time. So she called her close friend Pauline Coombs, who lived at a dairy farm that she ran with her husband Billy around a mile away. When Rosa spoke with Pauline and explained to her what had happened moments before, Pauline was astounded and terrified. She said that the exact same thing had just happened to her and her family a few moments before. The same two identical men came to her door and said the exact same thing before vanishing. But this wasn't the Coombs family only strange incident at the time either. Billy and Pauline Coombs ran Ripperston Dairy Farm, as I stated, and had three children, two girls and a boy. The family first saw a silver craft with a pulsating red light on it in March of 1977. It was hovering above their farm and they watched it float there motionless for around 5 to 7 minutes, Pauline said. Shortly after this, their nephew Mark, who lived nearby and was helping on their farm at the time, also witnessed a craft which had landed in a field on the farm's property. But it was while he was stood in the road observing this craft that he heard a rustling in the bushes that lined the roadside. After a moment or two, Mark said, a tall humanoid figure stepped out from the bushes into the road, looking directly at him. Mark said the person, or creature, was easily over 7 feet tall, with long limbs, arms and legs, and large feet. It had a greyish head, but Mark said he couldn't make out its facial features. Mark said he ran home when the creature began walking toward him. The creature that Mark saw matches entirely in physical description to the creatures that Rosa Granville had seen on her property sometime before. The two didn't know each other either. Shortly after this sighting by Mark, things got a bit more eerie for the Coombs family. The next day, Mark and his uncle Billy went to the location on the road that Mark had seen the creature step out the day before. Along the side of the road, Mark recalled, was a muddy verge. And within that verge, Mark and his uncle observed a rather large footprint. It was clearly a footprint, but it was more than twice the size of a grown man's foot. His uncle could fit both his feet inside the print, with several inches of space remaining. Further, the Coombs family were driving home from St. Ishmael's late one night when Kieran, their son, saw a craft in the sky behind the car. It was glowing red and appeared to be following them. Pauline, who was driving, said that she sped up faster to get away from the strange craft, who by now was shining an orange light downward onto the road like a powerful torch. The family hurriedly drove home. But a few hundred yards from their driveway, the craft shone a light on their car, and it immediately cut out and all power in the vehicle was lost. The family left the car and ran the remainder of the distance to their house. Around a week after this incident, on Thursday night at 10 p.m, April the 20th, Mr. and Mrs. Coombs were sat in their living room watching television. The children were all asleep in their beds. Billy had made his wife and himself a cup of tea, and they were settling down to watch a movie on the BBC. All of a sudden, they both saw a flash out of the corner of their eye. It came from outside of their window. When they looked, they were startled to see an extremely tall humanoid figure standing directly outside the window. Billy is quoted as saying that the figure must have easily been over 8 feet tall. Its head was above the top of the window line. It had really long legs and arms, and a silvery suit of some kind on its body. Pauline ran upstairs to get the children. She said that the creature was so tall its head reached the window in the upstairs bedroom where her daughters were asleep. Over the following months, the Coombs family experienced repeated close encounters with UFOs and their strange occupants. Incidents which left their car burnt out, destroyed by one of the crafts, and their television set catching fire during another sighting where a craft was above their house. Pauline had a sighting almost every month, she said. Some investigators were skeptical of some of the family's sensational claims, but it had to be noted that the family were in genuine terror and extremely scared of what was happening. In fact, during one sighting, Pauline called 999, which is the UK equivalent of 911. She reported the sighting to police and asked for help. Sergeant Ernie of the Dyfed Police Constabulary investigated. He recalled in a 1996 interview that the family were terrified beyond belief. He also commented, quote, "In all my 26 years service in the police, that was the most frightened family I had ever been to see. There was no doubt that they had experienced something unusual and traumatic. It was one of the most creepy things I had ever investigated." Unquote. So what the hell was going on in Pembrokeshire at this time? The Coombs family, often called the Granville family, when they observed strange phenomenon, and the Granvilles would corroborate the sightings from their location a mile away, and vice versa. On one occasion, while Rosa and her daughter Francine were sitting in their hotel restaurant, they both noticed a silver disc that pulsated an orange light hovering over the bay. To be sure she wasn't seeing things, Rosa called Pauline Coombs, who stated that her family were all watching it from their house too. Both families reported that the glowing craft slowly descended into the water in the bay behind Stack Rocks, which is an island just off the coast of Broadhaven. Once again, this is an interesting observation, because there are hundreds of UFO reports that are documented all the way back to the 1700s of sailors and coastal dwellers observing crafts enter or leave the seawater. These sightings and claims remain consistent to this day. Even the famous Captain Fravor UFO incident that was reported in the New York Times in 2017 involved a craft that had emerged from the water off the coast of San Diego in the United States. There seems to be growing consistency and stark parallels to what is being witnessed the world over. Following the earlier mentioned investigation by the RAF, they replied to the Parliamentary Under-Secretary for Defence, James Wellbeloved, said that apart from Mrs. Granville's report, the Ministry of Defence had, quote, "no record of unusual activity in the area," unquote. We know this wasn't true, however. There were 453 documented reports, and many of them to the RAF base at Broadie themselves. However, we now know that behind the public's knowledge, there was another discreet and very secretive investigation conducted, and it was even hidden from the politicians. On June 14, 1977, the head of S4, the Ministry of Defence branch which dealt with UFOs, took the unusual step of asking the Provost and Security Service, or PNSS, to make a discreet inquiry into events in West Wales. This clearly indicates any craft seen was not government or military in origin. The PNSS are responsible for policing the military, particularly the MOD and RAF, and they have a section which investigates complaints about aircraft. Early in 1977, the department moved to a secretive facility deep in the Wiltshire countryside called RAF Rudlow Manor. You might have heard of it. It's fairly infamous in UFO circles. That's because that Rudlow, rather than the UFO desk in Whitehall, where well-known MOD investigator Nick Pope was based in the 1990s, Rudlow Manor has for many years been the real and actual HQ for the British government's UFO task force. Ministry of Defence files declassified and released in 2006 throw new light on claims of a conspiracy involving Rudlow Manor. The documents support the claim that PNSS were involved in secret UFO work. James Peduzzi, the head of the Rudlow Manor UFO desk, wrote to the PNSS to assess, quote,
the volume of local interest and or alarm, and whether there is a readily discernible rational explanation, or whether there is prima facie evidence for a more serious specialist inquiry.
Peduzzi even went to some length to emphasise that his request must be treated in the strictest confidence, adding,
I have not even told the minister I am consulting you on this.
Due to the investigation being and still remaining highly classified, no final report from the PNSS investigation of events in the Welsh Triangle has been released. But in December 1977, in a secret briefing on UFO policy submitted to the MOD's Defence Intelligence Staff, Peduzzi wrote, quote,
there is always a steady public interest in UFOs, and from time to time it tends to increase unaccountably. In the summer, there was some concern in Wales, although the RAF police thought this could have been the work of a practical joker.
The same documents, released by the National Archives in 2006, also evidences how the government investigators attempted to intimidate witnesses and force them to keep their site in secret as, they said, not to scare the general public. The BBC reported on the release of these Ministry of Defence files when they were declassified by the National Archives back in 2006. This all seems to display a want to play down the events in West Wales. The MOD intelligence response is fairly disappointing, as it's something that has been easily debunked in the years since, though many locals still believe it to be the root cause of all the sightings. Glyn Edwards, a local businessman in Broadhaven, came forward in 1996, 19 years after the sightings, and admitted to being a prankster who was responsible for some of the sightings. Edwards, who was a member of the local Round Table of Business Owners, attended a fancy dress party with the Round Table in August of 1977. His costume was a silver asbestos-lined boiler suit. At the dinner, he joked with the other attendees that it would be funny to go to the Granville residence and see if they believed he was an alien returning to their property. The silver boiler suit, he thought, sounded like what those who had seen the creatures had described. The visit Edwards paid to the Granville residence amounted to nothing more than him having a photo taken in the costume in front of the Haven Fort Hotel sign. Rosa Granville and her husband actually knew in advance that Edwards would be playing this prank after another member of the Round Table of Businesses had called and tipped them off. Francine Granville, Rosa's daughter, stated in 2023 that her father actually went out and spoke to the two men when they were taking the prank photograph and politely asked them to leave. So they never actually pranked anyone. To further add water to Glyn Edwards' fire, his practical joke also occurred months and months after the sightings had taken place by the Coombs family, the Granville family, the school children, and hundreds of the other sightings. It also didn't explain the sightings of all the flying craft, which is far more difficult to hoax. In 1996, BBC presenter Ray Gosling tracked down Glyn Edwards for a Radio 4 documentary on the West Wales UFO sightings. This is where Edwards confessed to being a prankster in the area at the time. Following this, Gosling made attempts to contact and persuade the witnesses from Broadhaven Primary School to confess to all of it being a hoax. But the boys, by then middle-aged men, stuck firmly to their story. David Davis, for example, told him, quote,
"I did see something unexplained that day, and I will stick to that story for the rest of my life. I would have loved for it all to have been a hoax, as I was severely bullied and beaten during my school years, all because of what I saw. The bullies tried so hard to tell me that I was lying and had made it all up. But no matter how much they beat me up, I would never go back on my account of what I saw. I know what I saw was real."
The daughter of Bufora investigator Randall Jones Pugh, who was the first researcher to investigate the sightings, well, she said that her father became obsessed with the case and investigated it for quite some time, until he had a strange visit from someone from the government in the early 1980s. Following this, he dropped his research and would no longer work on or discuss the case or any ufology in general. Could this be another example of an instance evidenced in the declassified documents, which say witness intimidation was used? Journalist Hugh Turnbull, who detailed the events as a reporter for the local newspaper, The Western Telegraph, stated that his theory was that something military lay behind the sightings. There are some locals in the area, however, who believe that extraterrestrial beings had established an underground base beneath the Stack Rocks in St. Bride's Bay. Just to reiterate, these sightings and events took place 10 months before the release of Star Wars in the UK, and 14 months before the release of Close Encounters of the Third Kind in the UK. The reason why I emphasise this is because many sceptics will claim that UFOs and aliens were in the public psyche, the pop culture of the time, and were extremely popular. Whilst this was the case after the release of the aforementioned movies, in early 1977, that wasn't the case in the United Kingdom at all. Eyewitness David Davis has even stated that kids at the time thought of UFO movies as old-fashioned things from their parents' generation, and they weren't popular or talked about. What do you think? I would love to hear your thoughts and opinions on this. Drop me a message on Instagram, or if you were listening on YouTube, drop a comment below this video. Oddi wrth bob an ohonom and Dead Souls Media. Nos da bawb.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.